Okay, so now that we've done that, let's see if we can, does anybody have any comments, questions, or lingering things you'd like to say? Yes. Again, you're close enough to the microphone. Why don't you just grab one? I think they're on. Maybe. I mean, is that so? Yeah. It's wonderful that you're asking these kinds of questions about like how one awareness differs from another awareness, because it's true in a conventional sense. Yeah, we taste our food, we're eating. You want to stay there? Okay. In a conventional sense, yes, we taste our food, and yes, we know we're standing, and yes, we know we're breathing. But do we really? Is it really awareness, or is it some kind of vague sense that hasn't really blossomed into pure awareness or full awareness? And you're asking about what happens when you do come into a much greater sense of consciousness of what's going on in relationships between things. Yeah.
And when you come to the first thing, usually what I encounter is that people say, I'm aware all the time. Yeah. I'm aware all the time. No care about the teaching.
Okay. So thanks for clarifying that. So the fact that it matters is, it's not true. I mean, we are on automatic pilot almost all the time. And we think we're aware and we create stories about it, but, it's demonstrable in many different ways that we're not really aware. But listen for a moment. This is a little tricky, this retreat, because I'm trying to offer you the sort of the practices of MBSR and the direct experiencing of it, but because you're also professionals and you have aspirations to teach it and so forth, you'll be asking these second-order questions, some of which actually, if you drill down, come out of fear. Because it's like, okay, what am I going to do when I walk into the room and these people don't get it? And they say, I'm already aware. What the hell are you trying to teach me to be aware for? And that's a serious problem. Because you do have to be able to respond to that question. And yet, in this particular moment, it's a second-order thing because we're trying to get you and the raisin to speak with each other, and to just have the experience before you help other people to have the experience and also deal with their resistance, and there'll be lots of it. But interestingly, just to touch on that question and not go into it in any depth, the fact that people come in the first place, depending on how you set up a mindfulness-based intervention, people come for very interesting reasons, most of which, just like the well last night, you may not know. You may think you're coming for reasons A, B, and C, but really you're coming for reasons G, E, and F that you haven't even really, that have not reached consciousness in you at all, but something inside is just saying, this can't be all there is to life, or I can't take this anymore, I need something else to sort of round it out. And so people are voting with their feet, if you set it up correctly. And so in a certain way, you don't have to answer that question. You can actually trust in the practice itself to do the teaching for you. Because if we over-teach it, it will all be on the basis of discursive rational thought, exactly, and we'll be betraying what we're most teaching in the first place. Now, we're teaching on multiple channels simultaneously, but we do not have to start with the intellect and explain why mindfulness or why stress reduction is good for you before you eat the stupid raisin. You hear what I'm saying? But you have to have enough confidence that doing this silly, stupid raisin exercise, if that's what you want to do, isn't so silly, isn't so stupid, but they don't have to have an explanation of why. Let it come out of their own direct experience. Or out of hearing the conversation, because, you know, in a room with 25 or 30 people going through MBSR or MBCT, everybody's the teacher. It's not the person sitting in the teacher's seat that's the teacher. Everybody is teaching everybody else by their willingness to share what their experience is and to continue to practice together. And so the sort of learning and teaching function is distributive, and you can, it doesn't mean that you don't have to understand what you're doing as a teacher, but you have to equally, in some sense, have faith that the curriculum teaches itself when you understand what the curriculum is. And then people don't have to go away with a kind of be able to give a lecture on how mindfulness can, you know, modulate stress or pain or suffering. All they have to do is know that there are ways of being that are more liberating for themselves, and they know how to call on them and how to nurture them in themselves. And that's an ongoing lifetime's work. And then at a certain point, yes, it becomes useful perhaps, especially if you want to teach it, to be able to talk about this on multiple levels. But the idea of selling it to people on, say, the basis of recent studies of how the mindfulness and MBSR affects the brain, is not actually such good motivation. The best motivation has to do with how much suffering people are in, or how much interest people have for understanding who they are in a deep way. And very often it's suffering that brings us to that deep desire to understand who we are, because we don't want to live like this anymore. And so what is the alternative? And that becomes a very, very fruitful moment in a person's life. And as the instructor, you have to be able to, you come to hold that without trying to fix it. And the intellectual explanation would be a part of the fixing. And since we're all overeducated in that way anyway, it's very tempting to just go into thought, explain everything, and pull the rug out from under all of the power of the underlying Dharma approach to wisdom and to compassion and to kindness. So this is really a laboratory course rather than a theory course. And the laboratory is the practice, is life itself. So thank you. Any other comments, questions? Yes, please. The second raisin. Why don't you come up here and do it? Would you mind? Just so that we're sure that everybody can hear. Because the second raisin is very important. It's like the second arrow.
Maybe we can use this microphone.
That doesn't work very well. Yeah, I know it's a good idea, but the trouble with, the reason I'm not using it is because it's very dull for the ears.
Second raisin, well, your suggestions were based on conceptualization, not something direct. And yet I feel that it has to do with mindfulness.
You mean what I said about Thich Nhat Hanh and the water and the sky? And the
yeah,
yeah, of course, it's all conceptual. I'm well aware of that. Yeah. Yeah.
So how does this conceptualization relate to the experiential part of mindfulness?
Usually I don't even bother with that, just to tell you. But I figured there were a lot of Thich Nhat Hanh students here, so I wanted to just make the link. But, you know, it's not that we're saying that conceptualization is bad. If it serves the purpose of enriching your experience by recognizing that this object is in transit, it's not real in the conventional sense. It's not what you think it is, because it has a life cycle, and you're needing it at a particular moment in its life cycle. So that's true for everything, every manifestation on the planet. So if you begin to think of things as in transition, then rather than fixed objects that are solid and not going someplace, that gives you a lot more degrees of freedom for how to be in relationship to it. So it's a very poetic approach to see the rain in the raisin, and to see the sunlight in the raisin, and to see the ground in the raisin. Not because of the raisin or because we want you to get real conceptual about it, but because it's an invitation to kind of expand the way we hold reality, even in awareness, because after a while you don't have to think that, you just know it. In the non-conceptual way, you can use thought to describe it if you want to, but we're talking about something that's deeper and more based on a non-conceptual direct knowing. And we're, you know, for instance, how many of you, when we did the in the morning, okay, how many of you heard birds singing? Raise your hands if you heard birds. In fact, let's listen right now. Okay. You're not actually hearing birds. You realize that, of course. What we're hearing is, we're hearing that. That's why I didn't want to name the raisin raising the first time around. Because we're not actually hearing birds. What we're hearing is, and then something in the brain associates it with past experiences, and we know that those sounds are coming from birds, and then if an airplane came over, we'd know airplane, and if a cell phone went off, we'd know cell phone. But actually, they're just sounds, and we've connected them with certain kinds of meaning. And what we're cultivating here is that kind of deep first connection before thinking sets in. And that itself is very freeing. Very liberating, because as you've heard, I mean, when we're too much in the concept, we can't taste, we can't see, we can't hear, because we only hear what we want to hear. We only see what we want to see. And so this is a way of loosening those kind of contractions that, to a large degree, come from being so educated, so well educated, that we like to spend most of our time up here. Thank you. Yes.
Yes. And then of course we talk about even with the razor, I was wondering, it feels to me like that level of awareness and kind of impediment to going from point A to point B or dealing with the world. Mm-hmm. And what place do we have to bow up in to be able to function in the world?
Good point. The answer is, I don't know. It depends on a lot of different factors. There's no way that we can live without causing some harm in the world. Every step we take, on one level or another, we may be eradicating life. And so we wouldn't be able to actually move. It's in the nature of being human to, you know, be in some kind of dynamical balance with everything else that's happening. So when you walk on the grass, you may in fact trample some insects. But it's also true that the insects are used to it, and you may not be trampling them, because unless you've got them between, the ground is soft, and so you may actually be able to go over them and not kill them. Besides, you're not doing it intentionally. You're just being human, and you have to walk on the ground. You can make a big story in your head about how I don't want to harm anything, and then you'll basically have to be paralyzed your whole life. What's that? Yeah, and that would be harming yourself. So it's all a question of balance. Now, it's a very important question. How sensitive is too sensitive? If you get so sensitive that you can't function, that's not very useful. And it also may not be wise. So sensitivity and wisdom are not the same thing. Wisdom is being able to make wise choices about what how to hold things in balance. And the insects are the least of it. We have very serious human problems that where if we get, you know, extremely sensitive to the effects of our actions on other people, that could be a very good thing if we're able to change how we relate to other people in a way that favors more well-being of others and ourselves and less harm. But that's, that itself is a meditation practice, and requires a great deal of awareness of relationality and how we choose to be in the world. So there's no one catechism for anybody to follow, but rather cultivate your own inquiry around how sensitive is appropriate by exploration. Anybody else? Yes.
Let me tell you about another thing that derives from the racial experiment. First of all, if you wrote about the automatic silence you mentioned. Now, automatic silence is part of our mechanism to survive.
Yes, it is.
We humans also, the process of our civilization also added some pleasure aspects, hedonic aspects. In any way, in both cases, the fact that we are not aware of all the steps until we put the food in our mouth, in case, this fact is essential. You don't need to follow all the steps while feeding because you couldn't survive. So what I'm saying is that you artificially fragmented the process. And you pinpointed our attention to those steps, and therefore, for us, we, what we hear in this world, a different experiment.
Yeah, but it would, still have to do with awareness and in some sense unpacking the automaticity. Now, yeah, the automaticity can save your life, but it can also ruin your life. So again, we're talking about not eradicating what you know has been evolutionarily successful, but to a very large degree to examining it more deeply, because Most of the time, if we're living on automatic pilot, in some ways it can be valuable for us or even life-saving, but in many other ways it creates huge problems, social problems, relationship problems, in all sorts of ways. And so to be aware of our unconscious habits or our automaticity can be profoundly valuable. How you use it really depends on what your motivation is. And that's why I was asking so much last night, what your motivation is for being here. Why are you here? Because if it's just, in some sense, an intellectual engagement, you've come to the wrong place. I mean, it's like, you know, we got lots of things we can do with our time. So if you're, like, really attached to how evolutionarily successful the automatic pilot mode is, why bother coming here and watching your breath? Never mind the raising. You know, it's like so stupid. Why do I have to watch my breath? It's all taken care of by the brainstem. Well, yeah, but it also is a lot more complicated than that, because there's the whole rest of the brain, and how it functions can be deeply influenced by the quality of our attention. So again, it all boils down to why you're here, what your motivation is, because otherwise, when we engage in these practices, you'll be thinking about all the counterindications or why it's not actually, you know, useful or correct or whatever, and all your ideas and opinions will be just that. There'll be ideas and opinions that you could support with intellectual arguments and footnotes forever, but it wouldn't begin to touch these other, what you might call, hidden dimensions of our experience that are just as much the result of our evolution, but hardly ever get examined in our culture, except under certain circumstances. And what we're doing here is beginning to give more airtime, if you will, to those kinds of first-person experiences and seeing how they fit in with all of what we already know about the biology, so to speak, that's more sort of the ground, if you will, of our conscience. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate the observation. Yeah. Do you want to go there? You have to get closer to it, even though you're.
Okay. The main experience was the maintenance and appreciating when you said about six different hands, that everything you said, everything is in our place. The whole world, and the whole world is in this realm. And so usually I try, I guess like everyone, to sharpen my understanding. And more, I think that this understanding is not just the world, but it's a sense of wall. And the Hebrew word you said about putting the heart, so if we are so, so wise, why don't you use the Hebrew machine letter to pass moving from our head to our heart is so wise, because otherwise I can't experience this gratitude and sense. And I think this, when I try to rely upon my understanding, I don't get to any wise answers, because it's the same routine of thinking and thinking. And when it's going down by mindfulness, something comes out from my heart, and this raising experience brought it all up.
Thank you. Anything else? Yes, please. In what way?
It was such an amazing experience, the first one, so I was anticipating it again. So now I can't really distinguish between the two.
You mean in retrospect?
Also during.
During. So the second reason, you weren't quite as present for it because you knew what you were looking for? Is that fair to say it that way? Well, the answer is very simple. More mindfulness. In other words, a willingness to let go of the past, to notice how much it influences us, and to whatever degree it's possible, to let go of it and be available to the next moment. Now, that's easy to say. It turns out that that is, as I was saying last night, just about the hardest work in the world for us human beings. So we have to exercise the muscle. Okay? And how do you exercise the muscle? Exactly the way you are, by noticing the effect of the first reason on the second reason. So you say, oh, this is interesting. If I get too kind of caught in the first reason and create a story about the first reason, the narrative in your case has the expectation, fantastic. So the next reason, now you're coming to it not fresh. And if you know that you're coming to it not fresh, are you coming to it fresh or not fresh? So experiment with that. Okay, it's not like, oh, maybe I should tell you the answer. There's no answer. But if you're aware of how caught you are in a particular something, are you still caught? That, if there was one thing we work on in these 2 days, it would be that. It would be that. Every time you notice that in some way or other you've collapsed or condensed around a particular kind of idea or view that you think is either important or problematic, see if you can simply expand the awareness just the way we did when we went from breathing to the whole body last night. You remember? Started out with the breath, and then I invited you to expand the awareness to the body as a whole. And I don't think anybody had a problem with that, I'm guessing. That we can do that, because the awareness is just infinitely expandable. So, whenever we notice in these next 2 days, that's why I said that the curriculum is whatever happens. We've got 140 people here. Everybody's different. We've got different issues going on, different motivations for being here. Anything and everything is likely to come up, from not liking the food to not liking the people next to you, to not liking me, to wanting a different retreat, or whatever it is. It's all perfectly fine. That is your curriculum. It's your raisin. It's the stuff that we can work with. It's the clay. And the way we work with it is by asking, inquiring, looking deeply into whether our attachment to that view, whether our being in some sense grabbed by that view, and if we bring awareness to it, whether it's the same, or whether the awareness actually brings with it the opportunity to meet the second reason or this new moment fresh, as opposed to colored by our past experience. And that's something that will presumably and hopefully happen with virtually every breath, over and over and over again. The breath goes out, the breath comes in, the breath goes out. Let's say we're following the breath. The breath goes out, the breath comes in, the breath goes out, the breath comes in. And you get like this, Jesus Christ, why did I come here? I mean, this is so boring. Breathe, breathe, breathe. Breath comes in, and the instruction is always the same. Stay with it. In breath, out breath, in breath, out breath. Then the resistance comes up. I don't want to stay with this breath. You bring it back to the breath anyway. Mind wanders, you bring it back. Mind wanders, bring it back. Mind wanders. You notice what's on your mind. It's not like you just shut that out. Notice what's on your mind when it wanders, and you bring it back to here and now. That's how you connect with this moment. And when you are really in this moment, you don't have to worry about the past moment. This moment will be fresh, in spite of what happened in the last moment. And that's an experiment. You don't take my word for it. You have to play with that. Yes, there will be carryovers sometimes. And sometimes we may not be that fresh in this moment. But when we are aware that we're not being that fresh in this moment, then we can modulate that, and then in this moment or the next moment, new possibility. So for instance, how many of you have already experienced just being here some degree of pain, either physical pain in your body, first physical pain in the body? Wonderful. From our point of view, that's wonderful. I mean, pain is not a problem. It's like, how are we going to be in relationship to it? Now, ordinarily, what we want to do is take some aspirin, or take a pill, or wall it off, or make it better, or go for a walk. Do anything but put the welcome mat out. In this practice, we're actually turning toward what is unwanted. We're turning towards it. So it's kind of counterintuitive. And it requires, again, exercising this muscle in a very disciplined way, with openness, just like the Martian scientist, only now you don't have to be a Martian, you can be Israeli, an Israeli scientist. Okay, at the Weizmann Institute. And you're studying the most important object in the universe, yourself. And how does this arise, this even feeling of myself, and who I am, and what I like and what I don't like? And then you discover that maybe you, until this moment, you don't like raisins, then you ate a raisin, and it wasn't unpleasant. That whole story is like open to question. Any story is open to question. So let's say, and then it's not just physical pain, of course. We also bring enormous emotional pain everywhere we go. It's part of the human condition. And at different moments, some of us are more in touch with more of it. And of course, you know, if we've had any history of trauma or, you know, anything that has been harmful to us in any way, or that we've participated in harm to others in any way, we're carrying some residue of that. And so emotional pain will also be in this room, huge emotional pain. And what we're doing here is and that's the essence of MBSR, is we're inviting it into the room, because it's already in the room. If we're human beings, then it's going to be in the room. And the question is, can we make room for it? And can we turn towards it and put the welcome mat out for it and allow it to be here? And then ask ourselves an interesting question when we are practicing. Let's say we're feeling emotional pain or physical pain. Is my awareness of the pain, we can bring awareness to anything, not just to the taste of a raisin in our mouth. Is my awareness of the pain, or the fear, or the boredom, or any other mind state or body state that you get to, is my awareness of that pain, say, in pain? Is it suffering? And experiment, explore, just like the Martian scientist. You know, see for yourself for the first time. Not because you have an opinion or an ideology or a romantic notion about Buddhism or meditation, but for the first time, in this moment, even though you've seen raisins before, even though you've been in moments before, for this moment, how can I be in wiser relationship to what's arising now, my suffering, and look into it? And then ask some version of that question. If I embrace it in awareness, is it the same or different? Is it like the second raisin, the first raisin? If I hold the first one in awareness, does that actually, and my expectations of how it colors the second one, does that actually color the second one? And explore that. So two principles that will be the guiding sort of train track, so to speak, the two rails of this workshop will be: one, it's not the objects of attention so much as the attending itself. So you can keep coming back to that over and over and over again. Not about raisins. This is not a raisin seminar. Okay? It's not about the breath. It's not about thought. It's always about the awareness. and I've used the term at least once, pure awareness. When we're talking about pure awareness, and I'm not going to define it, just see if you can, in some sense or other, find pure awareness inside yourself. So it doesn't have any agenda whatsoever. It's not, it doesn't have an agenda. It's just your nature to be able to be aware without necessarily aware of anything. And then the other piece of it would be, when we rest in awareness in the face of the unwanted, unpleasant, undesirable, whether it's extremely unpleasant or just mildly unpleasant, or for that matter pleasant, is our awareness caught or is our awareness free? Just look. And if you have some kind of experience in one moment, then the next moment, it's open again. So we ask the question, we investigate over and over. It's not like, oh, okay, I get it. I can take the rest of the day off. You just stay in the process of looking, seeing, looking, seeing, feeling, sensing, knowing. And when I use the word knowing, it includes not knowing, and it really has to do with non-conceptual knowing, not shutting off thinking, but it's bigger than thinking. And we call it awareness. No, you have a word in Hebrew. You have no word in Hebrew for awareness? Not exactly. Okay, well then try to know it in English for now, okay, because I can't. Every language has its own challenges in terms of this. But since none of us speak Sanskrit or Pali, we're going to be doing this one in English. So seeing if you can keep coming back to awareness as the kind of core function that we're cultivating here today. We don't have to make it happen because we all have it already. The question is, can we inhabit it? Or are we so lost in thought, in our concepts, in our stories, in our narratives, that it's just one story after another, including good meditation stories? That's why I suggested that you throw out the thought that you're meditating. For the whole weekend, let's just throw out that we're meditating. When we're walking, it's not walking meditation, it's just walking with awareness. When we're sitting, throw out the idea, I'm sitting, because that brings a lot of special ideas, baggage to it. Just sitting. In the Zen tradition, their practice of shikantaza, pure awareness, it translates shikantaza into English, just sitting, nothing more. Turns out just sitting, nothing more is not so easy, because it's always something more. Always thinking, liking, disliking, wanting, pushing away. So just sitting. It doesn't matter if there's all this thinking going on. It doesn't matter if there's wanting going on. As long as we don't get caught in it, and we will get caught in it. Of course we'll get caught in it. We'll get caught in it over and over and over again. So we get caught, come back. Caught, we see how we're caught. We feel how we're caught. We feel it the way we taste it, the way it's in the mouth, and then we just let it be. We don't force it to go away, or we don't pursue it and cling to it because it's wonderful or interesting, or we just come back to this moment in its spaciousness, in its purity, in its wholeness, in its wakefulness. And let's call that awareness. And so it's an experiment. And just we're exercising this muscle. We lose it, we return. Go off, return. Go off, don't want to return? Return anyway. Return anyway. Go off, don't want to return? Really don't want to return? Return anyway. Not because I'm saying it or I'm making you do it, but because you came. You came for something. You came for something. But maybe what you came for is not a something. Maybe you didn't come for a thing. Maybe you came for something more interesting and more impossible to put into words. But trust whatever it was and stay in the process, because it's the process that's trustworthy. Much more than the teacher. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's about us. It's about us experimenting on what it means, with what it means to be human. And to be human in my body, in my little, you know, packaging, so to speak, with my name on it, and my age on it, and my story on it. But the stories, how many of you heard me talk either on Monday or Tuesday? How many of you were at one of the talks? And how many of you weren't, just so that I get it? So the vast majority of you haven't heard me talk about this work, okay? So, of course, this is not going to be a medical lecture, this is a retreat. But I will say that the brain science is beginning to actually illuminate some of the deep value of doing these kinds of practices, engaging these kinds of practices, because it's recruiting aspects of our brain that usually don't get recruited because we're usually so lost in thought and so lost in our narrative that we're continually caught in the narrative, the story of me. And when we like expand that in awareness, it's very interesting to even inquire, who am I? What is this? Who are these pronouns? What we call personal pronouns that so drive our lives. And we so want success for me, or my pain, or my suffering, or my ambition, or my joy, or my gratitude, or my happiness. And it's like, I, me, 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 my. And the Buddha is famous for having said that he taught for 45 years, nonstop. And he's famous for having said that all his teaching could be encapsulated in one sentence. Do you know that? Are you aware of that? Do you all know the sentence? No. So the sentence is, nothing is to be clung to, like the verb to cling, to be attached to, as I, me, or mine. Okay? So watch out for the personal pronouns, or what we often call selfing. You know, we're creating a self, and we're creating a story of me, and a story of myself, and now I'm a meditator, and now I'm enlightened. Or not enlightened, but on the way. And the problem is not with the enlightenment or on the way to anywhere. The problem is with the personal pronoun, the attachment to it. As long as we self-identify as anything, we're very far away from who we actually are. That's the assertion in these wisdom traditions. The neuroscience is beginning to support it. We have different networks in the brain that generate different modes of self-referencing, is the way they speak about it in the medical literature, in neuroscience literature. Modes of self-referencing. One has to do with narrative, the story of me. And it's usually what happens when the mind wanders, when we go into daydreaming or wandering or mind wandering, which we do a great deal of the time. Usually it has something to do with me and my story and where I'm going or how horrible it is and why it didn't work out correctly and why I'm so unhappy. And that's all just going on in the midline here. And if they put people in fMRI scanners and say, don't do anything, just lie in the scanner, that's what, it turns out the brain goes crazy. I mean, lots of activity here. And it's all this kind of what they call the default network. And a lot of it is just generating narrative. When you train an MBSR, another area of the brain lights up, more lateral, involves the insula and other structures in the cortex, that has to do with no time passing, no story of me, has to do with this moment, this breath, fully awake, experiencing. They call it experiencing, the experiential network. Okay? There's no story, it's just like this, this moment. Okay? And these two dimensions in the brain, these two networks in the brain, in MBSR, they are less tightly linked. They become uncoupled, and this one stands down a bit. So that the story doesn't dominate things, and it's just like, say, this moment, this breath. And the awareness that's simply here, and then can take whatever comes in the next moment or in this moment and hold it in a way that we can respond to, perhaps, with greater mindfulness rather than react to with greater automaticity and mindlessness. That's the challenge. And while I'm not going to be giving long lectures and this kind of thing, because I've already done that, this is different, please know that there's never been a time on the planet when... How many of you know the word Dharma? Raise your hand. Okay, so I use the word Dharma a lot, even though, you know, I'm not teaching Buddhism. But Buddhism, the word Dharma really means a number of different things, one of which is the teachings of the Buddha, which are universal teachings. They don't have anything to do with Buddhism, and Buddhism wasn't a Buddha. The Buddha wasn't a Buddha. And even the word Buddhism was coined by Europeans. Okay, so, you know, nobody thinks that the law of gravity is Italian because of Galileo. You know, and it only works in Italy. and the law of electromagnetism only works in England because of Maxwell and Faraday. They discovered a universal lawfulness. The Buddha did too. He was a certain kind of scientist, and he wasn't interested in electromagnetism or gravity. He was interested in another kind of gravity, which is why we suffer, why human beings suffer, and what is the nature of knowing, the nature of the mind, and how they work together, and how it might be possible to be free of the pain and the suffering that we create for ourselves through ignorance, through greed, through delusion. So this is all universal. And so we call it Dharma. He called it Dharma. It's the teachings of the Buddha, but it's also the lawfulness of all things. So the essence, if you call a program mindfulness-based, you can't call it, if it's not mindfulness-based, you shouldn't call it mindfulness-based. And if it is mindfulness-based, it's mindfulness-based because it's Dharma. If it's not Dharma, it's not going to be mindfulness-based. And so we have a lot of work to do, in some sense, to understand what this is really about in its most universal expression. So that, and this is not kind of to, you know, to say anything about Buddhism, but it's to simply say that in these mindfulness-based interventions, we're not teaching Buddhism, but we better be teaching Dharma, or it isn't mindfulness-based, and it, you know, it should be called something else. We don't care what you do, but don't call it mindfulness-based unless it's really coming from some deep form of practice in yourself, not from reading. Reading's fine, but it's extra. This is a reading of a different kind of book, you know, the book of the heart and of the breath and of life and of the world. So it's not that there's something wrong with narratives. I mean, these structures are just like every other structure. They wouldn't be here if they hadn't evolved for very, very important reasons. And human beings are like magnificent because we can create narratives about the past, about our history, about, you know, our possible future, about who we are, about the planet, about global warming, and bring evidence to bear to substantiate it. But usually, if you start to examine the narrative, if you bring mindfulness to the narrative, who am I, for instance, which is the most fundamental meditation practice, you can't get more fundamental, just ask yourself, who am I, and then see what comes up, and realize none of it's true. It's not that it's not somewhat true, but it's not completely true. Because we're much, much bigger than our narrative. So maybe we can, you know, find better narratives, larger narratives, and narratives that we're not so attached to, but that are more true, so we don't even need to be more attached to them, because they've got their own validity. And slowly over time, the world actually is growing in that direction. We are becoming more conscious. And if we don't become more conscious, we're going to actually, you know, we are capable of doing so much harm with this little human mind of ours, so much harm, that it's my view that that's why mindfulness has become so interesting to people recently. because this is no joke, folks. This is not just a nice little meditation retreat, and I feel so much better, and I feel so much calmer, and I feel so much clearer, and I can relate so much better. This is about the well-being of the world, and how, whether we can connect with our own deep wisdom as human beings, as a species. So there are lots of different levels, as I said, in which this unfolds, but for now, on this retreat, trying to keep it as close as you can to the actual experience of life unfolding here, in this very artificial, simplified environment where we're not reading, we're not writing, we're not, you know, talking to the outside world, we're not, you know, on the internet, we're not doing email, we're befriending ourselves. We're getting to know ourselves in a way that often we can't, because we're blasting through our moments to get to the next moment and to check off all the things on our to-do list. And our to-do list, I don't know if you've noticed it, is endless. Endless. So we become fantastic human doings, and the being part gets lost. So if you know, re-emphasize that what mindfulness is really about cultivating intimacy with the domain of being, whether it's through the raising, whether it's through the breath, whether it's through sounds, whether it's through awareness of thoughts and emotions, awareness of anything. It's that the awareness itself is the domain of being. And then out of the domain of being, we can do the doing in an entirely different way if we're awake and aware and grounded in fundamental experiencing of interconnectedness, then we may minimize the harm that we do ourselves and others, and we may actually find ways to optimize and maximize well-being, our own, and that would be called health. That would be called healing. And there's lots of evidence accumulating that when people practice in this way, they get better. In spite of medical treatment. Or they learn to live with the illnesses in ways that do not eradicate or, you know, their quality of life. Doctors are often saying to people, you're going to have to learn to live with this. And then they say goodbye. But what about, you're going to have to learn to live with this, and now we're going to teach you some very, very effective ways of the how of learning to live with whatever condition you may have. It's just a condition. We are much bigger than the condition and even the causes. And so we can relate to these causes and conditions in very imaginative ways, just the way we can say eat one raisin with full awareness and maybe take 5 minutes or 10 minutes rather than eating 100 raisins mindfully. Same raisin, entirely different experiences.